Hashtag murder may contain explicit and disturbing material and may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello,
and welcome to
Hashtag murder.
Woo! I'm Scar.
And I'm Alex.
And we're millennials who love murder.
And name change. Did we change our name?
No. No.
We're not doing it?
I thought about it. And then okay, funny story. So I was at work and I was talking to this guy. And he was like, oh, yeah, me and my brother, we started this business. And it kind of blew up because of social media. And I was like, oh, tell me your ways.
Tell me.
And so I was talking to him about it. And, oh, well, okay. His small business is, he invented the pop dart. Ever heard of that?
Pop what?
Pop dart?
Pop dart?
Mm-hmm.
Not a pop tart. Like a dart? Like throwing a dart?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they're like sticky, or, well, they're not sticky. They're like suction cups.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
One end? Yeah. And it's like a game and you throw them on a table or something.
Oh, the thing that's on your table?
Yes.
Okay, got it.
He gave me a set.
That's nice.
I know. But I was talking to him about it and he was like, no, just leave it the way it is.
Okay.
And I was cool. Like, okay, I'm going to believe you,
sir.
But anyways.
Yeah, share our shit, hash browns.
Yeah.
Just keep sharing.
I know. But we've gotten several more listeners. Oh, another lady from work. She sent us a very sweet email, Miss Melissa. She said that she listened and she listened from the beginning and I was like, don't start at the beginning because it's bad.
Mm-hmm. Oh, she liked it.
And she did. Yeah. Oh. It was really sweet. So thank you. Oh, also another fan shout out. Hold on.
Oh yeah. She thought I was from Jersey, right? Cause we drop the F-bomb a lot.
Oh, that was funny.
Yeah.
That wasn't who I was thinking of, but that is funny. She's like, I love how you use... Fuck is like a verb, noun, adjective.
It's everything.
Yeah. Who am I thinking of? She's got the dog. Miss Emily.
Oh, she shares our stuff a lot. The little weenie dog.
Yeah. Look, his name is Hans.
Hans.
Isn't that sweet? I know. She's been listening since the beginning.
She's an OG hash brown.
Yes. Oh, okay. So I had been drinking and I was like, I need to know all about Hans. And she said that she found him on Craigslist.
Okay.
I know. And that he was with the foster family and then they set up a home visit and she was like, getting a puppy must be like having CPS visit your house, I guess. And that the visit went well and that he stayed.
Some of those organizations that like foster the dogs and stuff like that, they're very serious about who they send them to.
Because
remember Harley and Clinton were trying to get this dog like, I don't know, 2020 I think it was, or 2021. Yeah. And the organization was like, no, because neither of you work from home. You can't have this dog.
Oh.
Remember that?
Oh, I don't remember that.
Yeah, I think it was pre-you and Dusty Buns. So maybe you weren't like dating yet.
Yeah. But that's crazy. No, that happened whenever I was looking for a dog, pre-Lillian. And I had reached out to somebody, and they said that I couldn't adopt whatever dog it was because I didn't have a vet. And I was like, well, I don't have a dog.
And what? What?
And I was like, well, my partner has a vet because... he's had Ollie. It was very confusing, and they were just like, no, you can't have this dog.
That's weird.
Because I hadn't pre-planned a vet.
I just found George on the street.
I know.
My little Georgie
little
boy.
Tripod potato.
R.I.P. George.
I know. He was the best.
And now I have two goddamn demon cats. But I have discovered that I am more of a cat person now.
Yeah.
Because no dog will ever be like George.
That's true. He's pretty irreplaceable.
He is.
Yeah.
What a good boy. Duck misses him too.
I know. I know. Now you're surrounded by cats.
Yep. And Noodle Doodle. The golden doodle. Oh.
Oh my God. Yes.
I have, you know how I did a Neneism a couple episodes ago?
Yeah.
Okay. I have a Puppaism.
Oh God.
Who is Nene's husband, yeah. AKA Ray's grandpa. Okay. And Kayla's dad.
Okay.
So anytime someone says something ridiculous or stupid or just shenanigans, he tells them to go fucking pound sand.
What does
which
that mean?
I had never heard before, but he says it all the time to Kayla and Nini and all these people. But basically it means like, go fuck yourself, or like, what you're saying makes no goddamn sense, so you might as well just go pound sand, because that's a worthless piece of time anyway.
Yeah. Oh, and it's funny you say that. This is going to be a long intro. We haven't seen each other in a while.
So now I say that to everybody.
Go pound sand.
Go fucking pound sand.
That reminds me. So, okay. Hoarders has a very special place in my heart.
You love some TLC. Is it TLC or is it Bravo?
Hoarders. I think it's A&E.
Okay.
I think. I don't know. I have it on recording. But anyways, I had never seen people interact with people the way this last episode I watched. And the psychiatrist, I think it was Dr. Tolan.
Mm-hmm.
The lady was being real, like... Everything she was saying, she was basically saying, go fuck off somewhere.
Yeah, go pound sand.
Yeah, but she wasn't saying that.
Mm-hmm.
And then at one point, the doctor was like, you know, you may as well just, like, give me the middle finger. Because that's essentially what you're doing. And I was like, Dr. Tolan!
You get him, Dr. T.
It was so funny. But anyways, there's a new season out, so I think that was the last episode in the new season that's out. I don't fucking know. But yeah, go Hoarders. Love it. Love a good mental illness.
We love and appreciate mental illness.
Yeah, because then I don't feel as insane, even though I am.
You are very insane.
And I might slightly be a little bit of a hoarder.
Yeah.
I definitely was as a child. I could not get rid of anything.
You do love some tchotchkes.
I do, and I always have, and I always will. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Dustin. Oh, my goodness. Okay, well, let's get into it. You sent me these notes once again.
Didn't read them.
Nope. So this is a surprise for everyone. Yay.
This would actually be typically a case that you would cover.
Old switcheroo.
Yeah. Okay. But I can't remember if I was like looking for one, because I was like in a slump where I couldn't find one that I really wanted to do.
Yeah.
But then I found this one, and it's a little love triangle mixed with a little sprinkle of incest.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And we're going to Texas.
I thought you were going to say Kentucky.
No, we're actually going to the two Floridas of our nation, Texas and Florida.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's do it. Love Texas.
So this is the story of Candy Mosler.
Candy.
Candace, but she goes by Candy.
Okay, second Candy we've had.
So this story really isn't going to be like the whodunit kind of story, because we already know whodunit. Everybody fucking knows whodunit.
Okay.
I could tell you the description of this, and you'd be like, oh, fucking Candy did it. But we're going to talk about
getting that out of the way
how we got there.
Okay.
Which is so much fun.
Oh, my.
So people across the nation were obsessed with this case because it was all over like the tabloids, and the trial was highly publicized just because it was so fucking wild. So Candy's husband would be the murder victim here.
Oh.
Jacques Mosler.
Jacques. All right.
He was a very successful banker and like financial broski. He did a bunch of little businesses. He basically ripped off the American people. As his job, as most finance men do.
Yeah.
But he was fucking loaded.
Oh.
And Candy, she loves a loaded man.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Spoiled Candy.
Yeah, and it's a tale as old as time. Yay. Dear old Candy murdered her husband.
Okay.
But the plot twist here is that her co-conspirator was her nephew, who also happened to be her lover.
Oh, what year are we in? I've never heard of this.
Well, Jacques is 25 years older than her.
Uh-oh.
Or 20 years older than her. So 20-something years older than her. And he was born in 1896.
Oh, we're going way back.
Way back.
Okay.
Well, not way, way back, but we'll get back to sort of not so way back.
Okay.
Because he doesn't get murdered for a while. He was just born in the 1800s. So Jacques Mosler was born May 5th, 1896 in Romania, and he was one of three children to Jacob and Sophie Moscovici.
You pronounced that.
I did.
Beautifully.
Pause here also. Kayla was on TikTok the other day, and you know how I be saying stuff wrong?
Yeah.
We know it. And it was this like TikTok of this guy basically being like, pronounce all these words. And she was like, honey, come here. Pronounce all these words. I did do them all right. And she's like, how can you get that word? I don't even remember what the fuck it was. But you can't say Des Moines. I was like, it's Des Moines. I sounded it out.
Oh, that's funny.
But anyway, he was a child of the Moscovici's, and he ends up getting the name Mosler because he Americanizes his name later on. Oh. Even though Moscovici is a way cooler fucking name.
Yeah.
But towards the end of the 19th century, when Romanian culture was becoming more and more hostile towards Jews, the Moscovici family was like packing up and like, we got to get the fucking hell out of here. Fuck this shit.
Yeah.
So they made the move to the U.S. and settled in Buffalo, New York in January of 1901.
Wow.
So baby, what's-his-face, Jock, was like 5.
Oh.
Yep. So in 1908, Jock's parents would actually end up separating, and he moved with his mother and siblings to Chicago, Illinois. His dad actually moved to the Bronx in New York and didn't really have anything to do with the family or kids, nothing. He just kind of did his own thing. Because, you know, dads can just leave their families. They don't matter.
That's
but
true.
But if a mom does that, she's a piece of shit.
That's true.
Yep.
Yeah. Good for him for getting out of that situation.
God, that poor man. Jacques ended up dropping out of school very soon after the move to Chicago, and he started selling newspapers and candy in order... The actual candy. Sorry. Like chocolate and stuff.
Not the human candy.
Not the human candy.
Okay.
To support the family. So he's basically like 12, 13, and he just drops out of school.
To be an entrepreneur.
He's an entrepreneur, if you say. Oh, buy this paper. Okay. In 1915, when Jacques turned 19, he changed his last name to Mosler in order to make it more Americanized because he wanted to fit in more.
Yeah.
Makes it easier to get a job and stuff, so like I get where he's coming from because we fucking suck.
Yeah.
He also moved to New Orleans around this time.
Love New Orleans.
Love it. I want to go. Never been, but I love it.
You never been?
No, I really want to go.
Oh, yeah. We just went there last year.
For Kylie's bachelorette,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. She called me on a Thursday morning mm-hmm. and said, hey, we're driving to New Orleans tomorrow. Do you want to meet us there? And I said yes. And mm-hmm. so I bought a plane ticket and went down there for the weekend.
New Orleans.
Oh, it was great.
So he moved to New Orleans around the same time, and he started working at a local car dealership as a loan manager. You know, the bros that finalize all your paperwork and stuff when you buy the car. They try to sell you all that extra shit, like the warranty, the protection package.
So annoying.
Yes.
Most annoying hour of my life.
Yes. Kayla has such a strong fondness for the loan managers.
Why?
She hates them. Oh. They were when she bought her car, they were really douchey because she didn't want to buy the protection package and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And so they were just dicks to her after
that. Because you don't
need
it. It's a brand new car.
Yeah.
You don't need it.
She's like, leave me the fuck alone. So this started his career in finance, and he would have many, many, many career opportunities in this field after being such a successful loan manager at the car dealership.
So no education, just go do that.
Yep, which is wild because nowadays
Different times. You
could not get a fucking job in this field without having like some sort of degree.
Yeah.
Or schooling of some sort. After working at this car dealership for a few years and learning the business, he left and started his own company, the Mosler Motor Exchange. He opened the company in 1918 with the help of some people he knew back home in Chicago, and off he goes.
All right.
They're like, yep, we know how hardworking you are and smart. Here's some cash. Go do your thing.
Nice.
He married his girlfriend the same year, Evelyn Kaiser. Evelyn actually worked at the company with Jock, and it became more and more successful as cars and vehicles became more common for the average family to need and own.
Yeah, because not everyone had a car.
No.
Oh, my grandmother, she's from, she is from Gatlinburg. But anyways, her family, her father was the first person in Gatlinburg to have a car.
That's wild.
Like the town. Where is it? No, not Gatlinburg. Sevierville, which is right outside of Gatlinburg.
Okay, so like it's like Goose Creek and Charleston.
Yeah.
Okay.
First one to have a car. It's crazy.
That's impressive.
I know.
But everybody started wanting cars then. Mm-hmm. Not everybody could afford a car. Mm-hmm. But that didn't stop Jock from helping them get that car.
Yeah.
He'll
do whatever it takes to sell you a car.
Yep. So along with this, you know how, you know, you buy a new fancy car, you can't make that payment on that car, and that car gets repossessed.
Yep.
Jacques loved that shit.
Okay.
So Jacques eventually used this opportunity to open a, like, car rental agency, and he also had a car repo.
He's selling, he's repoing, and he's renting.
Yep. He is doing everything car.
He's running the gambit.
He had one of the first car rental agencies in the Southeast.
Wow.
Which is impressive. Mm. For a man with no education from Romania.
Yeah.
By 1930, the Mosler family was growing, and they moved into a much bigger home in New Orleans, and Evelyn gave birth to 4 daughters.
Oh my.
Within 5 years.
No.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot of estrogen, as, as Chief would like to say.
It is, yeah.
That's a lot. So now we're in the 1950s, and the whole Mosler brand and company he had developed offered so many lending opportunities for clients both in Louisiana and Florida. Unfortunately for Jacques, the reason he was making so much money and becoming so successful was primarily based off the failure of these people he was offering loans to.
Yeah.
Like, he would offer high interest loans to people with poor credit ratings who would end up defaulting on their loans.
Yeah. He would take that down payment, and then 2 months later, he'd go and take the car back.
Yep.
And just sell it again.
Yep.
It's kind of ingenious, actually.
It's the American dream, if you will.
Yeah.
So one of the Mosler former business partners actually referred to him as cold-blooded and ruthless.
Yeah.
He also said a lot of other things, but he is the victim in this story, so we're not going to get into that.
Okay.
So now we're on to the star of the show.
Oh, boy.
Our dear old Candy Weatherby.
Candy.
Candy, who was born in small-town Buchanan, Georgia.
Where is... Which is Candy Candy. Where did the, what's that from?
I have no idea.
Oh, it's Bob's Burgers.
Oh,
Candy but Candy.
But I like the name Buchanan because it reminds me of the Great Gatsby.
Don't know the Great Gatsby.
Oh, what? Okay, well, the one of the,
I know it's got my boy Leo in it.
He does. And he dies.
Oh.
Spoiler alert.
You ruined it.
Sorry.
It's been out for like 12 years.
Yep. It's also a book.
I think I was supposed to read that in high school, and that just
didn't.
That didn't happen.
Yep. But she was born in small town Buchanan, Georgia. Huh. On February...
A Southern Belle.
A Southern Belle, if you will. On February 18th, 1920. And she was actually the 5th child of 9 siblings. So well. She's got... We got big middle child energy coming up.
She middle.
She middle. She's just not in the middle of 3 siblings. She's in the middle of 9.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of siblings. Life was really hard for this family. They were living in rural bumfuck Egypt, Georgia. And everyone in this family was supposed to like work on the family farm and support each other.
Mm-hmm.
The kids were taking care of the kids. Yada, yada.
Yeah.
In 1932, when Candy was 12, her mother gave birth to a stillborn child and also ended up passing away 2 days later due to the complications with the delivery.
Oh.
So now...
Tragic.
Her dad is the sole provider and caretaker for Candy and the 5 other siblings left in the home that weren't, like, grown and, like, of age yet.
Yeah.
The stress of the situation led to Lonnie, Candy's father, having a nervous breakdown.
As you would.
Yeah. He ended up leaving the children to the maternal grandparents and moved away to another close by town to try and, like, start over. But all he really did was, like, keep doing what he was doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, he just, like, dug himself a deeper hole into debt.
Yeah.
He wasn't even really a part of the kids' lives after that. He just kind of dropped them and left.
So we got some... Best of luck. Bye-bye.
So we got some abandonment issues, too.
Yep.
Living with the grandparents wasn't any different. Lifestyle was basically the same. So Candy, coming into her teenage years, did what she could to disassociate from real life and got really into fashion magazines and tabloids and just, like, whatever she could get her hands on to pretend that she wasn't living the life she was.
Yeah.
Because, like, there was nothing more than she wanted to just fucking leave that town.
Yeah.
We can understand that. Unfortunately for her, though, Grandpa was a Mormon bishop, and he had some different plans for his granddaughter. He already had a man picked out for her, and she was going to be married off to him, whether she wanted to or not.
Love a good arranged marriage.
Love that.
Oh, boy.
When she was 17, Candy was forced to drop out of high school and start dating a man named Albert Norman Johnson, who was 28 at the time.
Hmm.
They ended up getting married and moving to Alabama in 1939.
Huh. I guess I didn't realize that Mormons did arrange marriages.
I think they did back in the day. They don't probably do it now, but back in the day they did.
Yeah.
Norman ended up finding work as a superintendent for a concrete company and brought home about $1,300 a year, which equated to like 30 grand a year when I did the math, which is not great, but
not super great.
Stuff was also a lot cheaper back then, so.
Yeah, that's true.
3 years later, they gave birth to their first son, who they named Norman, after his dad.
Baby Norman.
Baby Norman. At 20 years old, this is not where she predicted her life to be, mm-hmm. and she was not happy at all. She didn't have anything in common with her husband. She didn't have any friends or social life at all, and she just, like, felt stuck.
As one would.
Yeah, I'd be fucking miserable, too.
Yeah.
So in the winter of 1942, however, things started turning around when she started volunteering as a hostess for the USO.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Fun.
I don't know how much truth there is to this story besides that she volunteered as a volunteer for the USO.
Okay.
You're going to love this.
All right.
She had joined this group at the beginning of World War I, and her and about 100 other women were shuttled off to Fort Benning, Alabama, to entertain the troops at like a little dance.
Oh. Mm. Entertain? Or like...
Entertain. Okay. You know, they were just like dancing and spending time with them.
Oh, okay. She's not a stripper.
No.
Okay. I thought that's where we were going.
No.
Okay.
It was here that Candy meets a man named Winthrop Wynn Rockefeller. And Candy said, oh, hello, Winthrop. He was a U.S. Army sergeant and the heir to a Rockefeller fortune.
Yeah, I was going to say, that name sounds very familiar.
I don't fucking know how much truth there is to that. I don't have any doubts that she probably met a man that she was, like, flirting with and having an affair with, but I don't think he was a Rockefeller.
She met a man.
She met a man.
We can believe that.
So, fortunately for Candy, Sergeant Rockefeller was stationed at Fort Benning. And according to Candy, the two started a little love affair.
Wow.
Eventually.
Do we have a photo of Candy?
Oh, yeah.
Is she hot?
Not my type, but yeah. That's her.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, she cute.
Yeah.
She pretty.
Mm-hmm. She kind of looks like a, I don't know, Dolly Parton, I guess?
A little Dolly.
Little
she got the big hair.
Yeah, it's the big blonde hair.
Yeah.
So this two, they have a little love affair going. Eventually, Candy became pregnant.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. With the Rockefeller's baby.
Wow.
And she gave birth to a daughter named Candace Rita Johnson.
She named her after herself?
Yeah.
She's Candace Jr.?
It's like a Lorelai Gilmore.
Who's that?
From Gilmore Girls?
No, I've never saw that.
Lorelai names her daughter after herself.
I like that.
It didn't seem that Norman knew about this affair, whether it happened or not, and he thought the baby was his. But there's also some speculation that this affair didn't happen. I don't think it did. I mean, I think she had an affair, just not with a Rockefeller. Yeah. And, like, she was just making shit up for attention.
Yeah.
In 1945, the Mosslers relocated to New Orleans. After about a year living in the new city, their marriage fell apart. Mm-hmm. And Candy was very nonchalant about it when, like, asked. They both just kind of like, we're getting divorced.
Yeah.
We're 11 years apart. We don't have anything in common. Bye. After divorce was finalized, Norman moved to Colorado, and Candy and the kids remained in New Orleans, and she aspired to be a fashion model.
Oh. Mm-hmm. I feel like New Orleans is kind of a weird place to do that, but okay.
Yeah, maybe be a stripper, but she actually did a few ads for some local clothing companies and eventually went on a little like trip to New York and was inspired for all the glam.
Mm-hmm.
And she even took some modeling classes while she was there.
Huh.
So now when she gets back to home to New Orleans, she starts her own company, the Candace Modeling and Self-Improvement School in the Garden District.
Wow.
And the Garden District apparently is rich as fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's where all the high society is.
Oh, God.
Self-improvement?
So, in local ads around the city, the company claimed its aims were to advise young ladies on fashion, makeup, and style, and to prepare them for modeling service, along with a bunch of other girly shit.
Yeah.
The school was successful enough to provide for the kids, but it's also rumored that the school wasn't doing that well at all, and she was actually an escort on the side to make ends meet.
There it is.
Yep.
Okay.
But you do you, girl. Who cares?
Yeah.
You're providing for your kids. She started volunteering with the New Orleans Opera in 1947 and wanted to work with prominent businessmen and arrange fundraisers, blah, 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 blah. And this is where she meets future hubby Jacques Mosler.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
here is where the train wreck begins.
Yep. She was like, you know what? I'm tired of escorting myself out. Mm-hmm. I want a rich husband.
Yeah.
So she went and found herself a rich husband.
Yep.
Machine
Gun. Was her name Candy? Beard? Candy? No, not Candy.
No.
What was her name?
Was it Linda? I don't remember. I know who you're talking about. It was the Beard family. We just did it. We literally just did it.
Hold on.
It reminds me of Machine Gun Kelly, though. His wife was like,
yes,
we gonna be rich.
Mm-hmm. We actually didn't just do that. That was back in August.
Oh, shit.
Celeste.
Oh. Another slutty name.
Celeste and Candy. Okay, sorry.
So, just like Candy, Jock had also just recently went through a divorce. But despite the 25-year age gap, the two hit it off and started dating.
Of course.
I'm sure she had lots of things she loved about Jock. His money.
His bank account.
His cash. His money.
His big house. His several fancy cars.
His several businesses.
Yeah.
Money. Yeah. Yeah. The two got married in 1949 while Jacques was on a business trip to Fort Lauderdale. Just a little, like, elopement. They were like, set aside some time to go get married here. This little trip to Florida inspired Jacques to move his family and company to Houston, Texas, because business was just fucking booming between finance and the oil industry.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, we're making another step. Let's go.
Yeah.
And so our girl, Candy, she was thriving in Houston.
Oh, yeah. They're going to follow that money,
mm-hmm,
wherever it may take them.
Jacques purchased some land, and the couple had a 3-story red brick mansion built for the new life they were going to be living in Houston. It was fully staffed with maids, butlers, chefs, fucking everything.
Hmm.
She didn't have to want or ask for a thing. It was already basically there for her.
Yeah.
They even had a chauffeur that drove Jacques to and from work, and it would take him and Candy out to, like, exclusive restaurants in Houston for dinner every night.
Wow.
Candy was determined to establish herself as the badass rich bitch she thought that she was. So she started writing checks to all the more prominent charities in Houston with Jacques' money, of course.
Yeah.
And she would throw fundraisers in her new mansion and just...
Yeah, she's a philanthropist.
She's fucking schmoozing all these rich bitches. Candy was actually very kind and charismatic and just fun to be around.
Yeah.
And apparently her philanthropy was, like, not all for show. She actually really enjoyed, like, donating to charity and, like, spending her time and dedicating herself to it.
Yeah.
Which is kind of nice.
Yeah.
Despite her murdering her husband. So one night in 1957, Jacques was on a business trip in Chicago when he called Candy to tell her about this story he read in the paper about these 4 children who had been orphaned after their father shot their mother and then stabbed their baby brother to death.
What?
Yeah.
What case is that?
I don't remember. I looked up the name of the kids and stuff, but I don't remember the actual name of the family.
Hmm.
The kids were left to no one and didn't have anyone else to take care of them. So they're all orphaned.
Yeah. So she's gonna adopt them.
Why are you gonna spoil it? So almost immediately, Candy got on a plane to Chicago, and her and Jacques signed temporary custody papers for all 4 of the kids and brought them back to Houston with her. Candy told every newspaper that reached out about it that they planned on adopting the kids permanently, and there was going to be nothing temporary about what was happening. She wanted to adopt those kids and make them a family.
And she's only got the one kid, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I think she felt like a pool. No, she has 2 kids. She has Norman and then her daughter.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yep.
Okay.
Both of them named after their parents. She has Norman and Candy.
They're both juniors.
She has NJ and CJ. Yeah. I think she felt a pull towards these kids based on, like, the shitty upbringing she had, mm-hmm, and knowing that they had no one to really take care of them, and she just wanted to make a difference and not let them go through what she did.
Yeah.
The 4 kids they adapted really well into their new situation, and Candy's 2 kids from her previous marriage were teenagers at this point, and they loved spending time with their new siblings. Apparently, the kids were just, like, really sweet, so fun to just be around, and
yeah,
probably all just, like, so thankful that they got pulled from that situation, because they probably all would have been, like, put into foster care and separated.
Yeah.
But instead, they all get to be together. Candy actually transformed the ballroom that was in the home into a playroom, and they would all go on family outings to, like, drive-in movies, bowling alleys, dinners, and they would take the kids to their vacation home in Galveston, Texas.
They're, like, giving them a great life.
Yeah, she's thriving. Like, she loves taking care of these kids.
When does she snap?
Oh, it gets...
I can feel the snap coming.
It's coming. It's like a rubber band.
Oh, God.
They also had a baseball field built across from their mansion on an empty lot that Jock owned. And one of Jock's employees actually taught the whole family how to play baseball.
That's funny. Reminds me of, have you seen Succession?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they go, they take the plane to the baseball field. Mm-hmm. Or is it kickball?
I think it's kickball.
Or maybe it's softball. I don't know. It just reminds me of that, though.
Yeah. This has big me energy. Yeah. So a few years come and go. Towards the end of the 1950s, family's thriving. Candy and Jock seem to be really happy. And then things start crumbling in 1961 when Candy's sister, Elizabeth, nicknamed Babe. She went by Babe.
Oh.
Which I thought was cute.
Yeah.
She calls Candy, and the entire family system is going to unravel shortly after this.
Oh.
So Babe has a 20-year-old son named Melvin, a.k.a. Mel Powers.
Oh, I forgot that you said... Okay. Mm-hmm. I remember now. Okay.
Who had just gotten arrested and convicted for fraud in Michigan after pursuing an 89-year-old man to buy $20,000 worth of stock in a fake magazine subscription.
Ah. He's also a swindler. Got a lot of swindlers in this episode.
It runs in the family.
Yeah.
Mel was only sentenced to 90 days in jail, which fucking seems ridiculous, but whatever. But now he's out. She wanted some help getting her son into a better path in life, and she thought her sister Candy would be able to help with that, since she was able to do so much with her own life and her own kids.
Yep.
Candy was like, hell yeah, I'm always down to help some family. Send Mel down here, and we'll get him back on his own feet.
Oh, she'll get him back on his feet.
Oh, yeah. She'll get him on his back, too.
Ew, stop.
Mel was born January 13th, 1942 in Birmingham, Alabama. A few years later, the family moved to Phoenix, Arizona, where his dad owned and operated Powers Aviation. They basically fueled, repaired, and sold small private aircrafts.
God damn.
Yep. Throughout his entire teenage life, Mel was a shithead. He never listened to his parents. He wanted to take shortcuts. He was very disrespectful, and his teachers and parents all referred to him as being lazy and rude, as well as a bully.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like, I mean, he had a very good life, and everything was given to him, so maybe a little bit of...
Spoiled.
Yes.
Yep.
Yep.
He was also a big fucking dude. He was 6'4", and he used his, like, intimidating presence to bully other kids.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. When Mel's father closed the aviation business in 1960, he took it as an opportunity to join a group of teenage dirtbags and travel the country, which is where the magazine subscription service comes from. He worked under, like, a career criminal selling this fake service. They basically went door-to-door and signed customers up for these fake magazines, and then they would take their money before they realized the whole thing was a scam. Yeah.
This world is so weird.
It's so fucking strange. This story is weird.
Yeah.
So from the moment our young stud, Mel, arrived in Houston, Candy was obsessed. She gave him a car to drive, his own room. She also gave him an appointment with a plastic surgeon who removed his tonsils, made his ears closer to his head, sanded his face to minimize his acne scars, and he also got circumcised.
Do we have a photo of this person?
Oh, yep, hold on.
Do we have a before and after?
I didn't find a before and after.
Got his ears pinned, I guess?
Yeah, I guess they were sticking out too far.
I wonder if that was his decision or her decision.
It was probably her decision, but he's
like,
probably
let's make you look a little bit better.
It's him.
Oh, I mean,
I think he looks like John Travolta.
A little, yeah. Mm-hmm. Little JT.
He's got a butt chin.
He does have a butt chin. Mm-hmm.
He does have big ears, though, so maybe that's why. They were just sticking out too far and she didn't like it.
I guess so. He's not bad looking.
Yeah. He looks like a jock.
Yes.
Like a sport jock, not Jacques.
Not Father Jacques.
Not Father Jacques. So, Jacques ends up hiring Mel to work as a repossessor for one of his auto loan companies, which, like, was perfect for him because he's such a big dude and such a fucking asshole that he was great at that. He loved that job, so he was like, hell yeah, let's do this.
Yeah.
Didn't last very long, though. And in 1963, about a year and a half after Mel arrived in Houston, he was fired from his job and escorted off the family property and forbidden from ever returning.
Oh.
Jacques also left at the same time and went to his condo that he owned in Key Biscayne, Florida.
Okay. Wait, do we know why he was banned? Never to return?
Or are you about to tell me?
Yep. Okay. I was like, did I miss that?
And then Key Biscayne is like close to Miami.
Oh.
When anyone asked Candy about this, she would say that Mel was leaving the company to start his own business, and that when Jacques found out, he was pissed and left.
Hmm.
I don't think so, Candy. In June of 1964, Candy and the kids all joined Jacques in Florida, and the kids saw nothing out of the ordinary. As far as they knew, it seemed like a normal family vacation that they did every summer.
Yeah.
Except for the frequent trips to the ER that Candy would have to make injections into her head for, like, terrible migraines.
Oh, Botox.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Well, she also got pain medication.
I didn't know that had been around that long.
I didn't know either, but basically she getting some migraines, so she was getting injections for them.
Okay.
All the time.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
This is important.
Is she really doing this?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
She actually was getting the injections.
Oh.
So the last of the ER visits came on the evening of June 30th, 1964. Candy piled all of the kids in the car and made a pit stop to a nearby, like, hotel to mail some letters, and then to another place to grab some dinner for the kids before they made it to the ER a little before midnight. Also, why are we taking all the kids to the ER?
Why are they going with you?
Why can't they just stay with Jacques? We'll find out why.
Oh, okay.
Yep. After waiting for several hours, Candy finally received her injection, and the kids and Candy all made their way back to the home where Jacques was. They arrive back to the home at 4:45 in the morning.
Okay.
To find Jacques.
Oh, no.
Lying dead in a pool of his own blood. And his black lab puppy, named Rocky, was leashed up to the balcony door, barking and screaming for help.
Oh, Rocky. And Jacques.
And Jacques.
Damn.
But Rocky, he's traumatized.
I know.
Jacques had been stabbed 39 times between the heart and lungs with a thin blade, and also bludgeoned on the head with a heavy object.
Oh no.
Instead of calling the police, Candy ran over to the neighbor's house, who called a local physician, Dr. John Handworker.
Okay, we're gonna have to come back to that last name.
Handworker?
I think it's too late for a doctor if someone's been stabbed 39 times.
And they didn't even reach him, they left a voicemail.
Wait, what's but his last name?
Again? Handworker.
Dr. Handworker.
Dr. Handy. But the reason that they did this is because Dr. John, he was friends with Jacques. Like, they were really good friends and buddies.
Huh.
I don't know why they didn't call the cops.
Yeah.
Strange.
Yeah.
But Dr. Handy did end up getting back to the family, and when he called back, he talked with 20-year-old Rita, who explained the situation to him, and she was panicking and told the doctor someone had broken into the apartment, and he was covered in blood, and that he was dead.
Like, is Rita the neighbor?
No, Rita is Candy's daughter. Her middle name's Rita. She goes by Rita.
Oh, Candy Jr.?
Candy Jr.
Okay.
Okay. Candy Jr. went by Rita, her middle name.
Okay.
But basically, she's like, freaking the fuck out. She's like, my dad's dead. I don't know what happened. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
He's covered in blood. So the doctor, he's a close friend of Jacques, and they knew each other very well. But he told Rita, Candy Jr., that they should have called the police, and that he would be there in about half an hour, because that's the closest, he's half an hour away.
Yeah.
So he jumps in the car. Rita's in hysterics, so he told her that he would call the police for the family. He's like, you know what? I will call, but, like, they're gonna be coming.
Yeah.
A deputy from the Miami-Dade Sheriff's Department arrived to the home to find Candy at the front door, and she said, quote, there's been some trouble.
I'll say.
Yeah.
My husband's dead on the ground with 39 stab wounds.
There's been some trouble.
Okay.
Yep. Jacques was lying on the floor, covered by a blanket that he'd used to cover up his body while they waited for the police to arrive, and his hand was still clutching the drapes, like, on the window.
Oh, creepy.
Mm-hmm. Creepy.
Oh, like, so he had grabbed onto him
mm-hmm.
and then died.
Yep.
And then
he was trying to, like, pull himself back up, I think, to go get help.
You know what? I think I was looking into this case, because mm-hmm. I remember thinking, like, he died while holding on to him, and he had to, like, rip the curtains out of
yep.
his dead hands.
Yep.
Ooh.
The deputy noted that Jacques was completely nude, except for a white t-shirt, and the entire thing was covered in blood. And Candy kept saying, oh, Jacques, what have you done?
What has he done?
What has he... Yeah.
I don't think he did anything.
And the deputies were like, what the fuck? Are you trying to, like, imply that your husband is the one responsible for his own murder? What the fuck is wrong with you?
What?
Yeah. So several days later, the autopsy was completed, and the coroner's report would conclude that he had two major blows to the head with a blunt object, but they never did recover what that object was. Mm-hmm. So it's still unknown. They don't know what he was killed with. Each of the 39 stab wounds were about 2 inches deep and would have required considerable force to do, especially that many times over.
Yeah.
Which indicated that the killer was most definitely a very strong individual.
Mm-hmm.
A large man, if you will.
Yep. A 6'4 man.
Mm-hmm.
Named Melvin.
We're like 2/3 of the way through. Do you want to order the food?
Yeah. And I gotta pee.
The blows to the heads themselves, those happened first. And they would have been enough to kill Jock. So the stab wounds, completely unnecessary, and just further proved that this was more than, like, likely a crime of passion and rage.
Yep.
Because it was just so much overkill.
Yeah.
39.
Oh, after he was probably already dead.
Yeah, he was done. Investigators went door to door to attempt at, like, getting a neighbor, getting a look at the assailant, or seeing anything that could lead them to catching a suspect. But no one really saw anything. All they got was a neighbor told the police that all she could really hear was the dog barking. That's it. And they're in a condo, which is essentially an apartment, and nobody heard shit.
Yeah.
So another neighbor heard the victim say, "No, don't do that to me," followed quickly by Rocky's barking. The noise prompted her to go to the door, and she heard someone close the Mosler's apartment and, like, heavy footsteps leaving. A few other witnesses also stated they put eyes on a white Chevy sedan leaving the apartment around the same time of the murder, and that this vehicle just so happened to be the same white sedan that Candy had requested from Jacques' company, Alan Parker, for them to drive while on vacation.
Mm-hmm.
And the rental company confirmed that the vehicle was returned by a tall, dark-haired man around 5:19 a.m., just a few hours after the murder.
Yep.
Police initially thought the murder was a robbery gone wrong due to Jacques' status in the finance industry.
Yeah.
But also that didn't quite sit with the investigators, since the murder itself was so brutal and full of rage, and nothing was, like, obviously missing.
Yeah. Real quick, what year are we in again?
62.
Okay.
No, 64. Hold on. 64.
Yep. And how old's Jacques?
68.
Okay.
Nothing was obviously missing from the home. There was no indication of forced entry. There was also no struggle at the crime scene, which means that the blows to the head definitely knocked Jock out before he could fight back.
Mm-hmm.
Detectives were running out of ideas for the leads, so they returned to Candy again to interview her and try to get some sort of insight on the life that Jock led and any enemies he might have had that wanted him dead.
Candy. Oh, I'm sure she's got a long list of people.
Oh, she ran with this. Candy was not your typical grieving wife. And we all know grief looks different in everybody. You sure. Can't really predict it.
Sure, sure, sure.
But she showed up to the station, and she was looking well put together. She looked calm. She looked like she got really great sleep. Mm-hmm. She looking fine. Candy told officers that her husband had many dealings with shady employees, and that business deals could have been gone south. Any one of them could have wanted her husband dead.
Yeah, she's got a point.
She does. She also pointed the finger at Jacques having young male lovers.
Oh.
Which there's no evidence of that at all.
Oh.
Yeah.
That would have been fun, though.
So I doubt it. I think she was just, she knew the time that they were in, and she's like, if I make him out to be like this fucking gay Romeo, that's what the jury will see.
Homosexual.
Homosexual. Candy would just be telling stories sometimes.
Yeah.
She claimed to have heard Jock on the phone with a feminine-sounding man, and she suspected that he was living a gay and secret life in Florida. He left their family back in Houston to go live a gay agenda.
Somebody call George W.
He is breaking the law. The next time Candy was visited by the investigators was on the morning of July 1st, and they found her in the company with her attorney, T.M. Doyle. He was a family friend, and she introduced the man as being named Vincent for whatever fucking reason.
And his initials are T.M.
Doyle? T.M. Doyle. His name is not Vincent. She also had two bodyguards with her to protect the family from whoever killed her husband, since she had obviously no idea who did it.
She could be next.
She could be next.
They could all be next. Yep. We don't know.
She pushed the theory of a burglary gone wrong again and said that she was missing thousands of dollars worth of jewelry. when the officers asked her to take an inventory of the missing items so they could check pawn shops. Her lawyer said that she was way too distraught to do that. Okay. They're like, okay, Candy. After she caught the hint that the officers were not buying her bullshit, she pivoted back to the story of a scorned gay lover and claimed to have received messages from several other men that had sexual relations with her dead husband. Candy be ridiculous. The detectives did not buy that bullshit again, and instead told her that they tracked down the white Chevy she had rented and found blood inside of the vehicle.
Whoops.
Whoopsies. Candy told them she knew nothing about it and claimed that they didn't even drive the car at all and didn't even need it. They returned it back.
Well, you had to drive it at some point because you took the car.
Yeah. Investigators printed the car and found a match that they had also found in the apartment of Jock Mosler. And who did that belong to?
Is it the dear old wayward nephew?
Melvin Lee Powers.
Melvin Lee Powers.
Which is weird because she said that the Chevy wasn't even used.
Yeah.
And isn't Melvin supposed to be banned from the property?
Yeah.
Strange. A few hours later, they uncovered 6 more fingerprints in the car. And since the car had been dropped off at the airport location, they made the rightful assumption that the killer probably jumped on a flight and got the hell out of Florida.
Oh, well, yeah.
Yep. So they ended up scoping through all the flights, and they found that the 7:10 a.m. flight from Miami to Houston was boarded by a man named M. Powers Mosler.
Okay.
Yeah.
I need you to do better with the fake names, my friend.
Yeah, like John Davis or something. I don't know. So, within a few days, it was pretty obvious who the killer was, but now they needed to figure out what the motive was behind this.
Mm-hmm.
On July 3rd, authorities arrested Melvin Powers at the newly established company he opened.
Oh.
It was a mobile home sales company.
They're all into sales.
Yeah.
And vehicles.
Yes. And the money that he used to open up this business was given to him by his dear Auntie Candy.
Oh, Auntie Candy.
Auntie Candy.
Ew.
With all the evidence we see here, it was easy for the authorities to now charge Melvin Powers with murder. He was held at Harris County Jail over the weekend, and while that was happening, investigators in Houston searched his home and business for any additional evidence that they could find.
Hmm.
On Monday, July...
Oh, wait, say that again? I totally just disassociated. I don't know what you said.
So, Melvin, he was being held at Harris County Jail over the weekend. And while that was happening, investigators in Houston took that time to search his home and business and vehicle for any additional evidence that they could find.
Okay, what do they find?
So on Monday, July 6th, a grand jury in Texas convened to figure out if they had enough evidence to charge Mel with anything.
Mm-hmm.
On July 7th, they had to take a recess because detectives announced that they potentially had significant evidence at the mobile home company that included letters addressed to Mel Powers. And they were only signed off with the letter C and had a return address of a Continental Hotel in Mexico.
Whoa. So that's where she was. That's why she went to the hotel? Mm-hmm. Is to send the letters?
Yep.
Oh, God.
The letters were romantic in nature.
Oh, Candy.
Oh, Candy. And by this time, Candy had returned to Houston and accused the DA of being out to get her, even though she's not being charged with anything.
Yeah.
When she found out that her lover, nephew, baby nephew, he got arrested. He's out to get me. And the DA was like, ma'am, you haven't even been accused of anything yet. And basically said, like, Candy, will you sit the fuck down and calm down?
That's like the brofies.
Mm-hmm.
And the wife was like, she's like, I just need a letter stating that I didn't murder my husband so I can get my insurance money.
Yeah. Her sister, Babe, also traveled to Houston at this time to visit with her son, and she told the press that he was a sweet boy and he could never have done something like this.
Oh.
My sweet little 6'4" fucking convicted felon. He would never.
He'd never.
Pretty soon, the love letter circled around to the press, not just in Houston, but around the nation as well. It wasn't even the first time this affair had been heard of either, because one of Candy's relatives spoke about how Jacques had walked in on Candy and her nephew.
Porkin.
Oh, no. And he was pissed. I mean, naturally, you would be pissed. You just found out your wife was banging her own nephew.
Yeah.
So, Candy fled the city when this news started spreading, and she checked herself into St. Luke's Hospital and told the doctors that she had a form of battle fatigue.
Oh.
She's just going through so much.
Okay.
The door to her room was surrounded by bodyguards she hired, but she would still let reporters in to interview her. And she had a whole-ass press conference where she denied any claims of incest and the affair with her nephew.
From her hospital bed?
From her hospital bed, yes. Okay. Where she was fighting battle fatigue.
Okay.
She ended up fleeing again to Minnesota, where she rented adjoining rooms at a hotel and spent a lot of time at the Mayo Clinic.
Is she even ill? Or is she just feigning illness?
I'm so ill. My husband just died. I'm being accused of all this stuff. So while all this is happening, Melvin's lawyers were fighting his extradition to Florida and trying to get him out on bond, which was very quickly denied. They're like, you have plenty of means to escape the state and the country if you want. You're not getting out on bond.
Yeah.
By June of 1965, Candy and her kids visited Arlington National Cemetery, where she hired a whole ass team to take photos of herself and the kids laying roses on Jock's grave that she sold to the press and gave like a whole sob story on Jock's death.
So she hired photographers to take these photos and then got those photos and then sold them to tabloids.
Yep. A month later, Mel and Candy were both indicted on the murder of Jacques Mosler.
There you go.
They both pled non-guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Shocking.
Yeah.
Both ended up being bonded and released after the indictment and were awaiting their trials back in Houston. Huh. Originally, the trials were supposed to start November of 1965, but it was delayed numerous times for random fucking shit that their attorneys were coming up with.
Yep.
And Candy, she used these opportunities to talk to the media.
Of course she did. Yep. She can't keep her goddamn mouth shut.
Yep, she cannot. She even went as far as to take her 11-year-old adopted child, Eddie, with her to court, where he told the press, quote, I'm here with my mommy, so they won't take her away from me to jail.
Okay.
Fuck you, Candy. Don't use your kid for that.
That's also, like,
what are you doing?
The Hawks murder.
Yes.
And the guy brought his baby. He was like, well, can't be arrested if I got my baby with me.
Yeah. So, eventually jury selection started in January of 1966, and Candy invited reporters to her new apartment that she was renting in Florida, and she just flaunted her domestic life. She's like, I'm just a normal little housewife. The trial eventually begins in February of 1966. The defense's main argument was to trash the victim, and, like, they spoke about his sexually deviant lifestyle.
Which there's no proof of.
No proof of, and even so, like, why are you outing this man? He's dead.
Yeah.
And even if he was, like...
Who cares?
Who cares? And that's not your place to out him.
And she slept with her nephew.
Yeah. And she's talking about having, like, the shady business dealings. It was this whole ass dramatic performance.
Uh-huh.
The prosecution's witnesses spoke about Candy and Mel being caught a-hugging and a-kissing. That is a direct quote. A-hugging and a-kissing. And several other witnesses said essentially the same thing.
Oh, man.
Another witness spoke about Mel calling Candy his wife and that Eddie was their child.
Oh.
Yeah, he said that Eddie was Candy's kid from a previous marriage, but now they're raising him together. That's their kid.
All of these people are so delusional.
They're so fucking stupid. The defense made this whole thing a very dramatic experience.
Mm-hmm.
They took every opportunity they could to accuse the prosecution's witnesses of retaliation or homosexual deeds.
No.
Or whatever they could think of. It's really Jock that's on trial, not Candy.
Yeah.
So, in usual Candy fashion, she would arrive to court every day in furs, stilettos, fancy gowns. Like, she was acting like this was the Grammys.
Yeah. Well, it's her time to shine. It's her own show.
Yeah. It's the Candy Show. Candy Court. By the end of the 31-day trial, everyone was exhausted and just ready for this shit to be over. Like, there's so much press. There's so much drama. They're like, let's just get this shit over with. Unfortunately, though, the prosecutor was monotone and boring as fuck to listen to. So in his closing argument, people were falling asleep. And it lasted 80 minutes.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's too long, sir.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so.
Jury deliberations lasted for 3 days before they came back with the decision that Mel and Candy were both not guilty. Literally, if they would have just had a better prosecutor, this would not have happened.
What?
Yeah. And as they left the courthouse, Candy was bombarded with fans who were so happy that she was declared not guilty. She had a whole fan club.
Wow.
And just 10 days after the murder, a book was published about the crime, and it was supposed to turn into a movie.
10 days?
10 days.
After the murder?
Oh, no. So just 10 days after the
trial.
The trial.
Okay.
A book was published about the crime, and it was supposed to turn into a movie.
Wow.
Candy claimed to not wanting a movie about her, the death of her husband.
No, that would be bad.
That'd be so bad.
That would bring up too many memories.
No. Poor Candy. Candy, though, did get a little bit of karma, because when she did return to Houston, no one from her former, like, fancy, rich, bougie circle wanted anything to do with her, because they knew she slept with her nephew and was guilty of that crime.
Well, yeah. And,
mm-hmm. Naturally, she inherited all of her husband's net worth and became a chairman of several of the companies her husband owned, and she even tried to open her own music production company, where she was going to produce love songs that she had been working on for years. Which is gross, because they were probably all about Mel.
Well, yeah. But, like, so she's... No one went to jail?
Nope.
Alex.
After the trial, the two lovebirds were together for a short little while, but their romance eventually fizzled out, and the two went their separate ways. Candy actually remarried in 1971 to a self-employed electrical contractor who owned a nightclub.
Did he know that she had orchestrated... Her first husband's murder.
But he was 20 years younger than she was.
Oh, she went the other way this time.
Yeah, we went backwards. So 1 year later, they got called to Candy's home, 1 year after the marriage, to find her new husband lying face down in a pool of blood.
No. She struck again.
He suffered from brain damage, a collapsed lung, broken ribs, and multiple lacerations.
No.
But he was still alive.
Oh.
And he lived. Uh-huh.
Okay, tell me.
Okay. So he had fallen 40 feet from their roof, and Candy claimed not to know what or why he, what the fuck he was doing up there. Unofficially, rumors were that he had become abusive in the relationship, and Candy stabbed him with an ice pick in the head, and then got a friend to help her push him off the roof. I think she got karma, and he married her for the money, because she's 20 years older than him.
Yeah.
Started being a dick, and then she was like, fuck you. Stabbed him with an ice pick.
On the roof. And knocked him off the roof.
Yep.
Okay.
He woke up 6 months later from his coma, not remembering anything.
Oh.
He didn't even remember that he had been married to Candy.
Oh, wow. I mean, that's probably for the best.
Yeah.
But also, she tried to kill him.
Yep.
So.
Candy eventually filed for divorce, stating that she still loved him, but that marriage would never be the same. She was also sued by her own children after she transferred their inheritance money into her own account, and she eventually also wrote them out of the will. But they were probably upset because she killed their dad.
Yeah.
In 1977, Candy flew to Miami for a board meeting for one of the companies she inherited in the death of her husband.
Yeah.
But she arrived and checked into her hotel. She called the doctor she always saw while she was down there because she was having a migraine and she needed an injection.
Yeah.
The doctor gave her an injection of a pain pill and a sedative, but what the good doctor did not know was that Candy had already taken a pain pill prior to his arrival. So the next morning,
she was found dead.
She was found dead by her secretary by accidental overdose.
Oh my God.
We love karma.
That was crazy. Mm-hmm. Oh, I've never heard of that.
I know, isn't that wild?
That was so good. Thank you so much. Oh my goodness.
Don't fuck your nephew and murder your husband.
And then try to murder your other husband.
Yeah.
Wow. That was crazy. And it sounded like, I mean, by all accounts, she was kind of a good person.
Yeah.
She adopted 4 children. She did a lot of charity work.
Yep.
And...
Mm-hmm. She was great to her children, by all accounts.
So weird.
Yeah.
So strange.
And she's just like, you know what? I love my nephew so much. I just want to be with him.
What happened to him?
He just lived his own life.
And
nothing.
We don't know anything?
Nope.
Wow.
Just kind of fizzled out. Nothing happened with him.
Damn. That was crazy.
He probably ripped some more people off, if we're being real.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness gracious. Okay, do you have any fun facts?
No.
Oh, well, that's okay.
We did have a long intro.
We did have a very long intro.
Mm-hmm.
Before you go.
Follow us on Instagram at Hashtag murder pod.
Spell it all out.
Spell it all out.
And if you like this, give us 5 stars.
And a review so we can read it.
Yeah. You can also do reviews on Spotify now.
Mm-hmm. And share us to all your friends.
Yeah.
Share us on your Instagram. We want to be popular. Scarlett doesn't want to work for a corporate company anymore.
I don't. I almost quit every day I go in. Oh my God, it's so bad. And we have a Patreon.
Oh yeah, we do have a Patreon. Do we have any new members?
No.
Scarlett's going to put a drunk episode on there for you guys.
Yeah, it might just be a regular episode. I don't know. But Dustin and I did one the other day. It was bad. I didn't realize how far gone we were.
If you guys ever listened to our episode that we did for my birthday back in May, it's like
on that level.
It's on that level.
It's bad. Oh my God. Okay, we have to go get our DoorDash now. I'm very excited.
I'm so excited. I'm.
That was a great idea.
I can't wait.
Then we're going to record another one.
We're getting ahead.
Yes. Well, thanks for hanging out.
Love you. Bye. Incest is bad. Don't do it. And maybe, I don't know, don't murder people.
Bye. Be fun, have safe.
Be fun, have safe, and go pound sand.
Thank you for listening to Hashtag Murder. Episodes are written and edited by Alex Lewis and Scarlett Hibden. Our intro and outro music is written and played by Derek Branton. Our cover art is by the lovely Lauren Walker. And our name was created by the most wonderful, supportive, and super hot boyfriend, Dustin Branton. We hope you've enjoyed your time with us. And if you have any questions, comments, concerns, or ideas, you can reach us at hashtagmurderpod@gmail.com. That's HASHTAG. murderpod@gmail.com. And don't forget to tell all of your friends about us. Thanks. Bye.
Hold on. God damn it. Who's that?
What do you want?
I don't know. Maybe somewhere different? Somewhere fun? What are our options?
It's so cute.
I should have gotten you one.
Investigators went door to door to attempt at a neighbor's getting a good look at the assailant or seeing anything that could lead them to catching a suspect. I know, I said hold it wrong.
Assailant. Okay, hold on, do that one again.
Investigators went door to door to like attempt at getting a neighbor to getting a look at the assailant.
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 One more time.
Investigators went door to door to try to find a neighbor getting a look at the assailant. I think I still said it wrong. God damn it.
The I is silent. It's just assailant.
Investigators went door to door.
We needed that because we haven't messed up much. So mm-hmm. We needed that. Okay.
Hold please. We're in the early 60s.
Okay.
Investigators printed the car and found a match that they also found in the apartment of Jacques Mosler. It just so happened to belong to a convicted felon by the man named...
By the man. Oh, God. In my glasses. Wait, start that one over again.
Huh. Mm-hmm. Oh, I bet Dustin would eat that. The 9 Patty Burger.
Yeah.
Or 69.
69.